For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the deaths of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war.
Ay me, I see the ruin of my house. The tiger now hath seized the gentle hind. Insulting tyranny begins to jut upon the innocent and aweless throne.
What is a man? Sure he made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused.
O my dear father, restoration hang thy medicine on my lips, and let this kiss repair those violent harms that my two sisters have in thy reverence made.
I am a king that find thee, and I know 'tis not the balm, the sceptre and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the throne he sits on, nor the pomp that beats on the high shore of the world.
This is the mighty history of the British Empire, a people living on a tiny island in the North Atlantic Ocean. Built an empire that circled the earth and brought freedom and education to languishing millions. This empire was blessed by Almighty God and one of his best educated teachers, William Shakespeare. Shakespeare has educated some of the greatest leaders of all time, such as Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill.
We shall never surrender.
Our troubled world needs a fresh crew of nation-building leaders. Are you ready to step up to the challenge? Welcome to the exciting classroom of Shakespeare's Royal Education with host Dennis Leap.
Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome back to Shakespeare's Royal Education. And I don't have any comments today, and I can accept that for today, but this is our second program now on the tragedy of King Richard II. So college is over here, school's out. You can take some time and write in and say how you really like Shakespeare. All right, so no comments, but I think in some ways that's good because I have a lot I would like to cover today. Now, on our last podcast, we began discussing some of the historical background related to King Richard II. And we also actually got through Act 1, Scene 1, and we got through Act 2. And so we really pushed along further than I thought we did. And but what I want to do for today's program, I want to continue discussing some additional background related to both Act 1, Scene 1, and then also Act 2. And I think you're going to find it interesting. Now, what I did is after the last podcast, I got online and I got into Spark Notes. And I think it's when you're reading Shakespeare, getting online and reading some Spark Notes is really good. It'll help you. And I was really curious, wanted to hear what Spark Notes had to say about, Richard II. And here's some things that are really interesting. And it's kind of like, why did William Shakespeare write this play? I think about it. Why did he write this play? This is taken right from Spark Notes. This is not my own thinking. I'm not plagiarizing. I'm telling you where I got it, so I can't get arrested for plagiarism. You can look it up on Spark Notes. Just go to Spark Notes, type in Richard II, say, explain Richard II to me, and the notes come out really well. Now, the thing that I'm interested in more is remember now, we just did King John, and King John was part of the Plantagenets, and his mother was very famous, and then of course he had his sons, and then they had sons, and remember Richard II is one of the sons of the Black Prince who died at the same time his father died, and that's why Richard II took the throne. And so here's what Spark Notes has to say. It says, Richard II was written around 1595. It's the first play in Shakespeare's second history tetralogy. And so what they mean by that is that Richard II is the beginning of a series of four plays. And it's the very beginning. And essentially, what is happening with these plays, and we're going to cover all four, in this series on Shakespeare. But what it is, this is the beginning of four plays that chronicle or give us the history of the rise of the House of Lancaster to the British throne. And so essentially, remember now that King John was the last, really, well, he had a couple sons in there as well, but they were the last of the Plantagenets. And so this book helps us get into the change to the Lancastrian line. And of course, we'll be in the middle of War of the Roses. But what's interesting is Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth I, was part of the Lancastrian line. And essentially, remember now, she never married, she never had any children, but she had to pass the throne off. And I do believe that Shakespeare actually wrote this to help her and to educate her. And so, she was born on September 7th, 1533. She reigned 44 years as queen. She reigned from 1558 to 1603. And so you can see that this play is being written in the middle of her rule. And she would have seen it. She would have been a part of it. And the other four plays that come after this are basically Henry the Fourth, Part One, Henry the Fourth, Part Two, and then we have Henry the Fifth. And so this is all the very beginning of all those plays. And so you can see that in some ways Shakespeare is giving us the history of one of the worst kings in that tetralogy. And then it kind of ends up with Henry V, who was the greatest king of the tetralogy. And so you can see that, I could just see almost, if I could look into that past and see Shakespeare, he probably has a map. Say, we're going to do Richard this one first, then we're going to do this one, then we're going to do this one, and he goes down the map. And then he shows what he's writing. So it is really interesting how that goes. Now, Richard II, the play itself is set in the year 1398. And so you can see, it's earlier than Queen Elizabeth. But what the play does, it does trace the fall from power of the last king of the House of the Plantagenets. So Richard was a Plantagenet. And this is where the house ends with Richard. And so it really is interesting. But he is replaced by the first Lancaster king, and that's Henry Bolingbroke, or Henry the Fourth. Now they're cousins. They're all related, because Henry Bolingbroke is the son of John of Gaunt. John of Gaunt was a brother. We go all the way back to the Black Prince. They're all related. And so this was the thing, is their father, Edward III, was so prolific. But, he had a lot of kids. He had a lot of sons. It created problems because they all could sit on the throne. And so they end up, what really happens is they end up fighting each other. And so Richard's the last king. And the thing is, he's replaced by the first Lancaster king, or his cousin, Henry Bolingbroke. And Henry takes the name Henry the Fourth, because, well, it's his first name, Henry. But he named himself Henry the Fourth. And so, it's really interesting. Now, Richard II, he ascended to the throne as a very young man. But Richard was basically raised almost primarily in France. And remember, we go all the way back to the Plantagenets. Remember, King John had to fight for the lands in France as well. His mother was really involved in France. There's all that war was going on at the time of John. And but Henry, not Henry, Richard II was raised in a French culture. And it would have been high culture. And so essentially, when he took the throne, he brought high culture to the throne in England. And, you know, that's really interesting. But Spark says he was regal, he was a stately figure, but he had his problems. And the big problem was he is wasteful in his spending habits, he's unwise in his choice of counselors, he's detached from his country and its common people, he spends too much of his time pursuing the latest Italian fashions, spending money on his close friends and raising taxes to fund his pet wars in Ireland. And so essentially what you have, and Shakespeare knows this from the history, you've got a royal brat in charge of England, and he's just spending money. He loves all these clothes. There's even some indication he may have been a little bit on the gay side and involved with his friends who were homosexuals with him. And, you know, that those are all things that were going on. But he was also married. And, it's just there's an unusual thing about him. So, but what's going on also in the play? Here's what they say. The commoners and the nobles alike feel perturbed when he begins to rent out parcels of English land to certain wealthy noblemen to fund one of his wars, and then seizes the lands and money of a recently deceased and much respected uncle to help fill his personal coffers. As a result, the subjects turn against their king. And so he actually loses control of England as well. And now we're going to get into this in the play, but I just wanted to have you start thinking about it. Now, Henry Bolingbroke, again, it's a little bit different. This is Richard's cousin, and their grandfather, Edward III, he made them both knights, and they swore an oath that they would never fight against each other. Well, that fell apart. Once everybody starts dying, it all fell apart. But Henry Bolingbroke, it's different now. He is a great favorite among the English commoners. One, because he's got common sense. He's working to help people. And so essentially, I think that's really, really good background for us to know. Now, what I want to do is let's go to page 14 in the playbook. And we've already done, as I said, Act 1, Scene 1. We've already done Act 1, Scene 2. And remember, Act 1, Scene 2 is John of Gaunt is talking with the Duchess of Gloucester. And, John of Gaunt is his uncle. And the Duchess of Gloucester is the wife of his brother Thomas. And his brother Thomas was executed. And the Duchess, we've already read this, the Duchess was complaining, that someone needed to stand up and, fight for her, and then fight to, make amends with whoever killed Thomas. And, John of Gaunt is one of the brothers. He's also Bolingbroke's father. And he was the younger brother. This is John of Gaunt was the younger brother to the Black Prince, who is Richard's father. So this is his younger brother. And John of Gaunt became very, very prominent during the reign of Richard II. In other words, in some ways, John of Gaunt was controlling the strings. Trying to really help his nephew. Okay, before we move on, I want to do this. I want to go back to Act 1, Scene 1. And we're going to go to page 11. There are about four or five key moments in this play. Scholars call them the key moments. And I just want to go back and just repeat this one for right now. So it's page 11. And again, it's we're going to be at line 196. And this is the king. And this is the king is talking to Mowbray and Bolingbroke. If you remember that scene from the last podcast, is Bolingbroke is actually what he's doing. He's going after Mowbray because he believes that Mowbray has killed his Uncle Thomas of Gloucester. That's what this whole thing is going on. And so that, you know, they come before the king and they throw their, you know, they throw their gloves down and they're going to fight each other and they're going to do this. And, you know, what comes really out in this one section is Richard II was big on government and was big on his authority. You did not mess with his authority. Now, remember, he's probably about 19 or 20 at this time, you know, and his, I think Bolingbroke would have probably been about 10 years older, or maybe no, they, I think they were pretty close in age. I think they're only 1 year apart. So, I think it is, that Bolingbroke was 1 year older than he was, but remember now, he can't get them to stop fighting. He says they have their gloves, they threw their gloves down and they neither one wanted to pick them up. And so it's essentially what he's doing here, and I'll read it here for you. It says, "We were not born to sue, but to command." And in other words, he's saying, "I was born to be king, and I'm not here to just play games with you guys. I'm commanding you what you need to do." And he goes on to say, "Which since we cannot do to make you friends, be ready as your lives shall answer it. At Coventry upon St. Lambert's Day." And in England, St. Lambert's Day is September 17th. So that's, I think that's still a holiday in England. "There shall your swords and lances arbitrate the swelling difference of your settled hate. Since we cannot atone you, we shall see justice design the victory chivalry. Lord Marshal, command our officers at arms, be ready to direct these home alarms." So that's the nice rhyming couplets of Shakespeare's writing. But essentially he said, "Look, I tried to settle this, I tried there not to spill blood, but now you're going to have to do the chivalric fight." And so essentially at that time, and it was Edward III that started all this with chivalry, is you could defend who's really telling the truth by who wins the war or who wins the battle. And if you really get a chance to see the movie, it's going to make it better for you to understand it, because it was, I mean, that it was like horses, and there was swords, there was, you know, they could knock each other out with lances and all that. It was, to me, it looked like fun, but it's just deadly. It's deadly. Can you imagine riding on a horse at, you know, 30 miles an hour and have a lance go right through your body? That's essentially what would happen. And then if whoever was the victor, they were considered, oh, they're the righteous ones. And so that's what was really, really going on. And he's really mad here. He says, "Be ready as your lives shall answer it at Coventry upon St. Lambert's Day. There shall your swords and lances arbitrate the swelling difference of your settled hate. Since we cannot atone you, we shall see justice designed the victory's chivalry. Lord Marshal, command our officers at arms, be ready to direct these home alarms." So you know, it's interesting. Then we already covered Act 1, Scene 2. This is John of Gaunt, and he's with the Duchess of Gloucester, or this is his brother's wife. This is brother's Thomas, his wife. And so it's really interesting going on here. So let's go to page 14 now. And so we will go now from to Act 1, Scene 3. And essentially we're at the, it says here, "Enter Lord Marshal and the Duke of Armorel." So essentially now we're at the battlefield where they're going to prove who is telling the truth and who is lying. And essentially, if you really look at this scene, and like I said, you can get the CD of this film for yourself, but it's really total medieval night scene. And, you know, they're all dressed in their they got these horns and their helmets and their, you know, their beavers, and which is the cover of their faces. They're down, and these got these beautiful horses, and they've got their lances, and they got everything going. And even as I just have it written here, Sparks says, this is a display of Edward III's aristocratic culture. You know, it's Edward III has started all this. And you still have the knights in England. They're still knighted in England. And they still meet. I don't think they actually spear each other, but they probably get drunk together, you know. So here's the marshal says, my Lord Armorall is Harry Hereford armed. And Armorall says yes at all points and longs to enter in. Then the marshal says, the Duke of Norfolk, spritefully and bold, stays but the summons of the appellant's trumpet. And so are both guys ready? And they're saying, yeah. Armorall says, why then the champions are prepared and stay for nothing but His Majesty's approach. So essentially, what the king did before is he said, well, you don't take my authority. You know, you don't accept my authority. You don't accept my decision. So I want you to have this fight. But they can't start the fight until the king shows up. And you're going to see here as we go through this, there's a reason what's going on. And Armorall says, why then the champions are prepared and stay for nothing but His Majesty's approach. So then if you look in the play, this is page 14, it says, the trumpets sound, the king enters with his nobles, Gaunt, Bushy, Bagot, Green, and others. Now Gaunt is his uncle, is the king's uncle. Bushy, Bagot, and Green are his friends. It says, when they are set, enter, and then Mowbray comes in, the Duke of Norfolk in arms defend it, and a herald comes in. So this is a big deal. And generally, I think it was, sometimes they were just parties and fun, and they were not necessarily to kill each other. But this is a pretty serious situation. So, top of page 15, he says, Marshal, demand of yonder champion the cause of his arrival here in arms, and ask his name, and orderly proceed to swear him in the justice of his cause. Now, essentially, what you see there is the king, or Richard, he wants everything done legally. He wants it look, you know, like this is very legal. This is like a court of law, you know, and he wants all these things. So, you know, here's his cousin. He knows both of these men. And actually, I'll read to you a little bit later that the person that actually executed his uncle is the king. He's the one that executed it. And the thing is, he had paid Mowbray to do it, essentially. And because the king doesn't want his uncle telling him what to do, basically is what it is. That's why he hates John of Gaunt as well. Yeah, because these guys, they're older, they know what they're doing, they know how to deal with the people. But he thought, well, if you look in the history, he never had any counselors with him. And so I think it was at 19 he demanded, I'm the king, you know, anoint me, you know, kind of thing. So the king says, Marshal, demand of yonder champion the cause of his arrival here in arms. Ask him his name and orderly proceed to swear him in the justice of his cause. And the marshal says, in God's name and the king, say who thou art and why thou comest thus knightly clad in arms, against what man thou comest and why thy quarrel. Speak truly on thy knighthood and thy oath, as so defend thee heaven and thy valor. So this is Mowbray now. He says, my name is Thomas Mowbray, Duke of Norfolk, who hither come engaged by my oath, which God defend a knight should violate. So that word defend there really should be translated forbid, which God forbid a knight should violate. So in other words, he took this knight oath as a knight, and you know he should be telling the truth, he should do honest things, he should never violate, you know, that oath. And he said, but I took this oath and both to defend my loyalty and truth to God my king and my succeeding issue against the Duke of Hereford that appeals me, or actually has brought him to court. You know, he said, and by the grace of God and this mine arm, to prove him in defending of myself, a traitor to my God, my king, and me, and as I truly fight, defend me, heaven. So then you hear the trumpet sound, and then Bolingbroke enters. And here is enter Bolingbroke, Duke of Hereford. He's a appellant. In other words, he's brought this lawsuit against Mowbray, and he's in armor, and he has a herald with him. And that's I guess that's one of the people that help him. If he gets a broken lance, they get another lance for him and things like that. So the king says then, Marshal, ask yonder knight in arms both who he is and why he cometh hither, thus plated in habiliments of war, and formally according to our law, to pose him in the justice of his cause. So here, essentially, the king has made himself like, you know, the head judge. And, you know, it's like he's the judge and the jury. And the marshal says, what is thy name, and wherefore comest thou hither? And before King Richard in his royal lists. And, you know, essentially, when you look at royal lists, that's monarchical rules and government. You know, that's his royal lists. Against whom who comest thou, and what's thy quarrel? Speak like a true knight, so defend thee heaven. And so... So the royal lists are like the adherents of the king, and these are his laws. And then Bolingbroke says, Harry of Hereford, Lancaster, and Derby am I, who ready here do stand in arms to prove by God's grace and my body's valor, in lists on Thomas Mowbray. So he's got legal complaints on Thomas Mowbray, Duke of Norfolk, that he is a traitor, foul, and dangerous, to God of heaven, King Richard, and to me, and as I truly fight, defend me, heaven. So then the marshal says, on pain of death, no person shall be so bold or daring hardy as to touch the lists, except the marshal and the such officers appointed to direct these fair designs. And so, in other words, no one else had to get, they could not get into the battle. It's these two men only. No one else could get in. So Bolingbroke then says, Lord Marshal, let me kiss my sovereign's hand and bow my knee before his majesty, for Mowbray and myself are like two men that vow a long and weary pilgrimage. Then let us take a ceremonious leave and loving farewell of our several friends. So Bolingbroke wants to kiss his cousin's hand. And again, it's kind of like a false show of love. They don't have love for each other. And maybe Bolingbroke has more love for Richard than Richard has for him. But the marshal says then, the appellant in all duty greets your highness and craves to kiss your hand and take his leave. And the king says, we will descend and fold him in our arms. Cousin of Hereford, as thy cause is right, so be thy fortune in this royal fight. Farewell, my blood, which if today thou shed, lament we may, but not revenge the dead. So that's really a sting. You know, what he's basically saying to him, basically, if you kill yourself out there, there's nothing I can do. You know, that's where it's just a real sting. And he said, look, we will descend and fold him in our arms, cousin of Hereford, as thy cause is right. So be thy fortune in this royal fight. So in other words, basically what he's saying, if you're killed, you're dead. That's it. You know, he said you weren't right. You know, and now we're all righteous except for you. He said, lament we may. And it's, in other words, if you die, lament we may, but not revenge the dead. In other words, I'm not going to go after Mowbray. And the reason he doesn't want to go after Mowbray is Mowbray knows who killed Uncle Thomas. And Mowbray was supposed to do it. He didn't do it right away. And, of course, King Richard was getting on his back. And then it finally took place the way it should, according to the king. Bolingbroke then says, oh, let no noble eye profane a tear. For me, if I be gored with Mowbray's spear, as confident as the falcon's flight against a bird, do I with Mowbray fight. My loving lord, I take my leave of you, O you, my noble cousin, Lord Amaral, not sick, although I have to do with death, but lusty young and cheerily drawn breath. Lo, as at English feast, so I regreet the daintiest last to make the end most sweet. O thou, the earthly author of my blood, whose youthful spirit in me regenerate, doth with a twofold vigor lift me up to reach at victory above my head, and proof unto mine armor with thy prayers, and with thy blessing steal my lance's point, that it may enter Mowbray's waxen coat, and furbish new the name of John of Gaunt, even in the lusty behavior of his son. And so in other words, he's saying, I want to please my dad, John of Gaunt. And but you can see the poetry here. And one of the things, everybody out there listening, is if you really listen to Richard's lines, Richard was known to be a poet. And the way Shakespeare wrote all of his words, there's poetry at the end. There's rhyming couplets in all of it. And so you can see that Shakespeare really, really plans. He really plans everything out. Now, Gaunt then says, this is his dad, God and thy good cause make thee prosperous. Be swift like lightning in the execution, and let thy blows doubly redoubled fall like amazing thunder on the cask. Or that's a cask, really could be a helmet, of thy adverse pernicious enemy. Rouse up thy youthful blood, be valiant and live. Now remember, if you go, remember back to Act 1, Scene 2, the Thomas's wife is wanting Gaunt to get back at whoever, to find whoever killed Thomas and take care of it. You know, in other words, she wants him to revenge her husband's death. And, you know, John, remember now, he really does have a spiritual side to him. He says, you let God take care of this. That's what we need. You let God take care of it. And so that's where, and with John of Gaunt, I think Shakespeare does show his interest in the Bible and Bible verses, and he really brings that out there. So then Bolingbroke, after his dad speaks, says, mine in innocence and St. George to thrive. Then Mowbray says, however God or fortune cast my lot, there lives or dies, true to King Richard's throne, a loyal, just, and upright gentleman, never did captive with a freer heart cast off his chains of bondage and embrace his golden, uncontrolled enfranchisement. More than my dancing soul does celebrate this feast of battle with mine adversary, my most mighty liege, and my companion peers. Take from my mouth the wish of happy years, as gentle and as jocund as to the jest. Go I to fight. Truth has a quiet breast. The king says, then for while my lord securely I espy, virtue with valor crouched in thine eye, order the trial marshal and begin. And so essentially right here you can see that it seems like that the king really does favor Mowbray. He's in it with them. And that's why. I mean, they're in it together. They wanted Thomas killed. The marshal says, Harry of Hereford, Lancaster, and Derby, receive thy lance, and God defend the right. Then Bolingbroke says, strong as a tower in hope, I cry, amen. Then the marshal says to an officer, go bear this lance to Thomas, Duke of Norfolk. And then the first herald says, Harry of Hereford, Lancaster, and Derby stands here for God, his sovereign and himself, on pain to be found false and recreant, to prove the Duke of Norfolk, Thomas Mowbray, a traitor to his God, his king in him, and dares him to set forward to the fight. So then the second herald says, here stands Thomas Mowbray, Duke of Norfolk, on pain to be found false and recreant, both to defend himself and to approve Henry of Hereford, Lancaster, and Derby to God his sovereign, and to him disloyal, courageously with a free desire, attending but the signal to begin. So the marshal says, sound the trumpets and set forward embankments. And then, a charge is sounded. And then all of a sudden, this is the second key moment in the play. And the charge is sounded. they take off, and what the king does, he stops it, stops everything. He says, "Stay, the king has thrown his warder down." And the king says, "Let them lay by their helmets and their spears," and both return back to their chairs again. "Withdraw with us and let the trumpet sound. We will return these dukes what we decree." So he's saying now, I'm not going to rely on this fight. I'm going to make the decree. And so essentially, if they really did believe that God would make the decision with this fight, King Richard didn't want to do that because he wants to preserve Mowbray. That's what he wants to do. And if Bolingbroke had, lanced him to his death, he would look like he's in favor. You know, he would look like he's the winner. So anyway, the king he seems very civil here. Like he's just really the best judge and ruler. But it's really, he's a criminal. And the king goes on to say, "Draw near and list," that's the adherents, "and list what with our counsel we have done, for that our kingdom's earth should not be soiled with the dear blood that it hath fostered, and for our eyes to hate the dire aspect of civil wounds plowed up with neighbor's sword, and for we thank the eagle-winged pride of sky-aspiring and ambitious thoughts, with rival-hating envy set on you, to wake our peace, which in our country's cradle draws a sweet infant breath of gentle sleep." And so essentially, if you really knew the history here, is there was a big battle at Radicott Bridge again against Richard, and they lost. And that's what he's talking about here. And again, you have to really understand the some of the history behind it. And so the king is really, really kind of still frustrated that they lost the battle. Remember now, as I said from the notes, he was really hurting England with taxation. He was renting land to other people. I mean, he was really creating a really bad economy. And the people were rebelling at Radicott Bridge, and he lost. He lost the battle there. And he said, "With rival-hating envy set on you, to wake our peace, which in our country's cradle draws the sweet infant breath of gentle sleep, with so roused up and boisterous untuned drums, with harshing resounding trumpets' dreadful bray, and grating shock of wrathful iron arms, might from our quiet confines fright fair peace, and make us wait in our kindred's blood. Therefore we banish you, you our territories. You, cousin Hereford, upon pain of life, twice till five summers have enriched our fields." So in some way, what he's decided, he's just going to banish both men. He's going to get them out of England. And he's banishing Hereford for 10 years. 10 summers, he's going to be gone. And in other words, that's his decision. There's not going to be any bloodshed, none of this chivalry stuff. And he said, twice five summers have enriched our fields, shall not regreet our fair dominions, but tread the stranger paths of banishment. So he's not allowed back into England for 10 summers. And Bolingbroke is really supportive of government. He says, "Your will be done. This must my comfort be, that sun that warms you here shall shine on me, and those his golden beams to you here lent shall point on me my guilt and my banishment." And the king says, "Norfolk, for thee remains a heavier doom, which I will some unwillingness pronounce. The sly slow hours shall not determinate the dateless limit of thy dear exile. The hopeless word of never to return, breath I against thee upon pain of life." So essentially, what's happening here is he's banishing Mowbray for life. And that protects who? It protects the king, because he's in cahoots with Mowbray. And so he's banished from life. But notice this. He says, the hopeless word of never to return, breathe I against thee upon pain of life. And so in some ways, he's acting like Christ. And remember when Christ was telling the disciples, they were still afraid of the Jews and all that. But remember, he said, you know, don't leave until you go to Pentecost. And then he breathed on them, you know, because they were going to get the Holy Spirit. And so now he breathes like on Norfolk, you know, so it's strange what he's doing. And then Mowbray says, a heavy sentence, my most sovereign liege, and all unlooked for from your highness' mouth, a dearer merit, not so deep a maim as to be cast forth in the common air. I have deserved at your highness' hands the language I have learnt these 40 years, my native English, now I must forego, and now my tongue's use is to me no more that an unstringed viol or harp, or like a cunning instrument cased up, or being open put into his hands, that knows not touch to tune the harmony, within my mouth you have enjailed my tongue, doubly poor custled with my teeth and lips, and dull unfeeling barren ignorance is made my jailer to attend on me. I am too old to fawn upon a nurse, too far in years to be a pupil now. Why is thy sentence then but speechless death, which robs my tongue from breathing native breath? And so Mowbray knows that he's been dumped. He knows it. That's what's happened. And the king says, it boots thee not to be compassionate. After our sentence, plaining comes too late. So that's just nasty. He can't even say explaining. He says plaining, you know. After our sentence, plaining comes too late. I'm not listening anymore. Mowbray says then, thus I turn me from my country's light to dwell in solemn shades of endless night. And so the king says, return again and take an oath with me. Lay on our royal sword your banished hands. So this is both Bolingbroke and Mowbray. They now have to make an oath with the king. He says, lay on our royal sword your banished hands. Swear by the duty that you owe to God. Our part therein we banish with yourselves. To keep the oath that we administer, you never shall, so help you truth and God, embrace each other's love in banishment. Nor never look upon each other's face, nor never write, regret, nor reconcile this lowering tempest of your homebred hate, nor never by advising purpose meet to plot, contrive, or complot any ill against us, our state, our subjects, or our land. So essentially, he's going back to Radicot Bridge. He says, I don't want any more people fighting me. So you're banished. You stay banished. You never get together again. You never come against the government again. You never do that. And Bolingbroke says, I swear. And Mowbray says, and I to keep all this. And then Bolingbroke has to get his last words in here. He says, Norfolk, so far as to mine enemy, by this time had the king permitted us, one of our souls had wandered in the air, banished this frail sepulchre of our flesh, as now our flesh is banished from the land. Confess thy treasons ere thou fly the realm, since thou hast far to go, bear not along the clogging burden of a guilty soul. So Bolingbroke gets in there and says, okay, we're committed to be alive. Had this not happened, maybe one of our souls would be wandering in the air because we'd be dead. But now we're not dead, and now we can't stay in the land. Well, confess your treasons, you know. And he said, ere before we fly the realm, just tell everybody. Tell them what you did, you know. And so Bolingbroke really, really believes that Mowbray was used by the king to kill his uncle. Now Mowbray says, and this is kind of like a prophecy, and Mowbray says, no, Bolingbroke, If ever I were traitor, my name be blotted from the book of life, and I from heaven banished as from hence. But what art thou? God, thou and I do know, and all too soon I fear the king shall rue. Farewell, my liege, now no way can I stray, save back to England, and all the world's my way. And so in some ways, Mowbray knows he's been dumped by the king, and he's ticked. You know, the king says, Uncle, even in the glasses of thine eye, I see thy grieved heart, thy sad aspect, hath from the number of his banished years plucked four away. So this is he's looking at John of Gaunt at this point, and he sees how John of Gaunt is getting older, and he's not far from death, and his son is banished, you know, for all those years, he could be dead. And then, you know, the king looks at his uncle and says, hey, you know, okay. He says, I'll take four back. So that's what he did. So he has 6 years of banishment instead of 10 now. He said, I'll give you, he says to Bolingbroke, 6 frozen winters spent, return with welcome home from banishment. So he said, okay, you only have 6 winters now. And Bolingbroke says, how long a time lies in one little word, 4 lagging winters and 4 wanton springs, and in a word such as the breath of kings. And then the Gaunt then says, I thank my liege that in regard of me he shortens 4 years of my son's exile. But little vantage shall I reap thereby, for ere the 6 years that he hath to spend can change their moons and bring their times about. My oil-dried lamp and time-be-wasted light shall be extinct with age and endless night. My inch of taper will be burnt and done, and blinded death not to let me see my son. And the king says, why, uncle, thou hast many years to live. What a jerk. My uncle. And then God says, but not a minute, king, that thou can give me. Shorten my days, thou canst with solemn sorrow, and pluck my nights from me, but not lend a morrow. Thou canst help time to fur me with age, but stops no wrinkle in this pilgrimage. Thy word is current with him for my death, but dead thy kingdom cannot buy my breath. And that's a really interesting paragraph. And it's very poetic, but he said, hey, you can't give me my breath. You can't keep me alive. You know. The king says then, thy son is banished upon good advice, whereto thy tongue a party verdict gave. Why at our justice seems thou to lower or to scowl? So John of Gaunt has a scowl on his face now. He's not ready to say, thank you, king. And then Gaunt says, things sweet to taste prove in digestion sour. You urged me as a judge, but I had rather you would have bid me argue like a father. Oh, had it been a stranger, not my child, to smooth his fault, I should have been more mild. A partial slander sought I to avoid, and in the sentence my own life destroyed. Alas, I looked where some of you would say I was too strict to make mine own away. But you gave leave to my unwilling tongue against my will to do myself this wrong. And so John is really not happy. And again, Thomas's his wife, Gaunt, they all suspect that Richard killed Thomas. The king says, cousin, farewell, and uncle bid him so. 6 years we banish him, and he shall go. And the king then exits with his train. Now, Armoral, who is a cousin, he says, cousin, farewell, what presence must not know? In other words, Armoral couldn't stay there. He says, from where you do remain, let paper show. Then the marshal says, my lord, no leave take I, for I will ride as far as land will let me by your side. And so essentially, they want to make sure that they leave. They want to make sure they get off England's, you know, nation. And God says, oh, to what purpose dost thou hoard thy words that thou returnest to no greeting to thy friends? And Bolingbroke says, I have too few to take my leave of you when the tongue's office should be prodigal, to breathe the abundant dolor or the grief of my heart. God, thy grief is but the absence for a time. And Bolingbroke says, joy absent, grief is present for that time. What is six winters? They are quickly gone. So Bolingbroke's dad is trying to say to him, look, you can get through this. 6 years isn't that long. You can get through it. Then God says, what is six winters? They are quickly gone. Bolingbroke, to men enjoy, but grief makes 1 hour 10. And he said, look, I'm upset. I can't leave. If I have 1 hour, it's going to seem like 10 hours. And God says, call it a travail that thou takest for pleasure. And Bolingbroke says, my heart will sigh when I miscall it so, which finds it in an enforced pilgrimage. And God says, the sullen passage of thy weary steps, esteem as foil in wherein thou art to set the precious jewel of thy home return. He said, well, think about the future. Think about when you get out there, think about you're going to return home and you're going to be happy then, and just look forward to that. And then Bolingbroke says, nay, rather, every tedious stride I make will but remember me what a deal of world I wander from the jewels that I love. Must I not serve a long apprenticehood to foreign passages, and in the end have my freedom boast of nothing else but that I was a journeyman to grief? And then gone. He really goes into this. This is really it's a really good section of the play. And what Gott really does is he gives him wisdom in trial. This is a big trial for his son. But now he's telling him, look, here's how you to deal with this. He says, all places that the eye of heaven visits are to a wise man ports and happy havens. Teach thy necessity to reason thus. There is no virtue like necessity. Think not the king did banish thee, but thou the king. Woe doth the heavier sit. So he's saying, look, don't think about the king banished you. Think about the king. What's his life going to be like? Woe doth a heavier sit, where it perceives it is but faintly born. Go, say I sent thee forth to purchase honor, and not the king exiled thee, or supposed devouring pestilence hangs in our air, and thou art flying to a fresher clime. He said, yeah, don't look at it this way. Just say, look, just pretend I'm sending you to get honor. You know, it really does sound like the Proverbs, if you really put it together. It sounds like the wisdom of Solomon. He goes on to say, look what thy soul holds dear. Imagine it. You know, that's what you need to focus on. To lie that way that thou goest, not whence thou comest. Suppose the singing birds musicians. So when you're out there and you're on your way to France is where he was going. He says, well, think of the birds. They're great musicians. The grass whereon thou treadest, the present stewed, the flowers, fair ladies, and thy steps no more than a delightful measure or a dance. So go out to the field, dance around the flowers when you're there. Don't do it in the wintertime. Do it in the summer. Says, for gnarling sorrow has less power to bite the man that mocks it and sets it light. Bolingbroke goes on to say, oh, what can hold a fire in his hand by thinking on the frosty caucus? It says, or dull the hungry edge of appetite by bare imagination of a feast. He says, how if I just sit around and think, oh, I'm at a big feast, and what am I going to do when I don't see any food? You know, it'll be too dull. He says, he goes on to say, or wallow naked in December snow by thinking on the fantastic summer's heat. That's funny. So if he's in the winter and it's like, man, am I supposed to try and pretend that summer? Oh no, the apprehension of the good gives but the greater feeling to the worse. Fell sorrow tooth that never rankle more than when he bites, but lances not the sore. And then Gaunt does say to him, come, my son, I'll bring thee on thy way. Had I thy youth and cause, I would not stay. And then Bolingbroke says, then, England's ground farewell, sweet soil adieu, my mother and my nurse that bears me yet. Wherein I wander, boast of this I can, thou banished yet a true-born English man. And so he finally does accept it, and he's going to do it like a true Englishman. He's going to get through it. All right. Well, we just have a few more minutes here. So I'm going to go ahead and just go ahead and start on Act 1, Scene 4. And this is kind of revealing as well. It says, "Enter the king with Green Bagot at one door and the Lord Armoral at another." And the king says, "We did observe, Cousin Armoral, how far brought you High Hereford on his way." And notice he's always making fun of Hereford, that he's stuck up, you know, kind of guy. Armoral says, "I brought High Hereford, if you call him so, but to the next highway, and there I left him." King says, "And say, what store of parting tears were shed?" Armoral says, "Faith, none for me, except for the northeast wind, which then blew bitterly against our faces, awake the sleeping room, and so by chance did grace our hollow parting with the tear." So he said, look, it was pretty cold out there, pretty windy. If you've ever been around Oklahoma and it's cold and windy, you're not going to shed a tear for anybody either. You know, he said, I didn't shed a tear. And he said, "What said our cousin when you parted with him?" And Armoral says, "Farewell." He said, "Farewell." And, Armoral did not say farewell, by the way. And that was a lie. He said, "And for my heart's disdain that my tongue should so profane the word that taught me craft, to counterfeit oppression of such grief, that words seem buried in my sorrow's grave. Merry would the word farewell have lengthened hours and added years to his short banishment. He should have had a volume of farewells, but since it would not, he had none of me." Okay, so Armoral, I have a little note here. Armoral did not say farewell. I'm going to have to get a magnifying glass to see what this note said. But anyway, I think it's one of my students. I think it was Jack Wood, by the way. How are you, Jack? He's down there in Australia. I think Jack is the one that's what he gave me this note, that Armoral did not say farewell. And Armoral didn't care for his cousin either. I mean, they're cousins, by the way. And it says he just was happy to have him go. All right. Well, that's all the time I have for today's program. Now, next time, on our next podcast, we will continue discussing Richard II. Please write me any comments you may have to comments@kpcg.fm. You can also comment at my Twitter page, Shakespeare's Royal Education. Now, you'll be able to find a good used copy of King Richard. And at this point, I'm not going to recommend abebooks.com anymore, because they're having problems with their people that sell with them, and I guess they are charging more than they should, and so ABE Books is not, I'm not going to recommend it anymore. But there are other, there's Thrift Books, there's some other books out there, other book companies out there. If you just get on the line and look for them, you'll be able to find it. Also, you can remember to get David Starkey's Ground and Country, if you can. And we'll do some research for you. I'll get my best producer, Dan, to help me find some good book companies you can find books. So thanks for joining me next time as we advance our royal education.
You've been listening to Shakespeare's Royal Education on Trumpet Radio. 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.